You?
What?
It's a little, just a little wet here today.
Rain.
Oh, but that's at least an improvement, isn't it?
Yes, it
That's
is.
true. Well, I'll bet it's a little warmer over there, Ginger. We're in the 40s someplace here.
That's only about 75, 80 here.
Oh.
Aw. Gee. So we're calling to make arrangements to come and conduct this interview in person, Ginger.
I think that's quite realistic.
It may take a month, right, to finish it.
Right. Maureen knows how to do it.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much for agreeing to do the interview. This is for the Oral Archives, and since the tape recorder is running, I should probably say at the outset that this is the first interview with Virginia S. Henshaw, the former dean of the graduate school. She is now the chancellor of the University of Hawaii. The interview is being done on March 31st, 2009. The interviewers are Charles Reed and Marita Weiss. Okay, with that on the tape, first of all, give us an idea of how much time you can spare today, Ginger. We know you have a busy schedule.
They have me scheduled for about an hour.
Okay. Well, we'll just do what we can in that amount of time, and then if you're willing to do some more and want to do some more, we will. We have an outline here in front of us, and the oral history program wants us to get some background information. Actually, the big first section of the outline is the early years through undergraduate education, and then graduate education and work experience before Wisconsin, and then your career at UW-Madison. You can see that we won't even get to your being dean of the graduate school
Today.
today, probably. If that's but assuming you're willing to do some more of this on another day.
That'll be fine.
Okay. According to the outline here, we should ask you first about your childhood and family, where you grew up, where you were born and when, and especially I think formative experiences and family expectations that might have influenced your decision to go into the fields that you went into and into higher education generally.
I was born in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. I was actually the first baby born there in the hospital because my daddy worked for the Atomic Energy Commission, and that was when they were building the atomic bomb.
Oh.
That's the reason some people say I'm a little unusual. But we moved around a lot because he also worked for NASA. So my childhood, I moved to a lot of different places. And I had a great family. My parents were wonderful. Always told me I could do whatever I wanted if I was willing to work hard and stay positive.
Well, you've certainly done that, both of
Well,
us.
they also told me that their hearts smiled when they looked at me. That was always lovely, and it took me a little while to realize not everybody felt that way. They always did. I had two older brothers, and so we as I said, we moved around a good bit, which I think was very impacting on me, and the fact that you had to learn to be flexible and pretty resilient. Like, I went to three different high schools.
Wow.
Ooh.
And so that was part of my upbringing, but in a very loving, supportive family. I mean, that was probably the huge difference. And they never made anything. They always had high expectations about your academic accomplishments. They encouraged you to be involved in lots of different things. And I decided when I was 8, I wanted to be a microbiologist.
Wow.
Oh.
And that was because I was a voracious reader, and still am. And often for kids who move around a good bit, the books are often your friends.
Yeah.
Because it takes you a while to get into, and believe it or not, I was kind of shy at certain points of my.
We don't.
Hard to believe now, but actually the moving made me change. You had to get in and get to know people quicker. But what happened, I read Microbe Hunters, and I decided to do a science fair on penicillin mold because I was intrigued by Alexander Fleming.
Oh, yeah.
A discoverer of penicillin. Mm-hmm. And so I read a book, and I must have misread, because I'm sure the book said you could grow the mold on the pot liquor, the leftover fluid from vegetables.
Uh-huh.
On nutrients in there, but I thought it said corn liquor. And illegal booze or moonshine. And we were living in Aiken, South Carolina at the time, and so I told my mother I couldn't do the science project because we didn't have any moonshine. And she thought maybe 2 seconds, and then she said, oh, that's no problem. The probate judge that handled all the moonshine cases.
Oh.
So what we, she said, we'll just go down to the courthouse and collect some of the evidence. And so that's what we did, and my mold grew beautifully, and I won the science fair. I became a microbiologist.
And was it actually penicillin that you grew or something else?
No.
Yeah, I did my experiments, and, moonshine actually, if it's left to sit around for a while, the alcohol will vaporize.
Uh-huh.
But it has a lot of nutrients in it from the corn and the sources that have been used to make it.
Uh-huh.
So it liked it a lot. I think that was when I learned some of my biggest lessons in knocking the T off the word can't. Kind of been that was kind of our family's approach to things. If you came up and said you can't do something, they very quickly turned around, well, let's talk about how you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it taught me about, having a plan, listening to others, being resilient, that if it doesn't go quite the way you'd hoped, you change directions and keep on trying. And you have to just stay positive about what you're doing, and you'll get a better outcome. And I think I still use those same strategies.
Yeah, I think you do too.
And so I grew up in that way, and I went to, three different high schools. The last one was where I met Bill, and who's now been my husband for almost 45 years. And so we took a little different. We got married not long out of high school, a year out of high school, and then we went through college together. His parents sent him, and my parents sent me, and we changed from, he was majoring in pre-med, and then he changed it to pharmacy, so we went from the University of Alabama to Auburn.
Uh-huh. So you started at Alabama.
Yeah, in Alabama.
Uh-huh.
Because my daddy had worked at Huntsville, where they had the Marshall Space Flight Center with NASA.
Uh-huh.
I worked there in the summers as well.
Oh.
What exactly did you
do? I got to meet Wernher von Braun, a fantastic mind, and... But he didn't like to mow his grass, so he concreted it and painted it green. Well, see, he figured out the taking the T off the word can't, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we went to school together at Auburn. I had a great major professor in graduate school, Dr. Emilio Mora, who was a very pivotal mentor in my life. Bill had already moved to do his training in pharmacy because they had to go someplace, to do a residency for a year.
Yeah.
And he was in Richmond, Virginia, so I decided to stop at that point and go join him. And so then we worked in Richmond, and then Bill was called into the service because he was in advanced ROTC during Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And then we lived, but I had one son in Richmond right towards the end of the time there, and then we moved to Denver, Colorado, where he was stationed at Fitzsimmons, and had another son there. And I worked at home, actually, for 3 years during that time.
Oh, really?
Yep. This is my route has been a little bit unusual.
Yes.
Well, you're a person who makes some key decisions early. I mean, you decided at 8 to be a microbiologist, and you married your high school sweetheart. Those were pretty defining decisions at early ages.
I think our parents, my parents too, they put a lot of responsibility for decision making on us. And it, and I was the youngest, and so I actually had probably the easier route of the others, and the only girl.
You were the youngest of? Three. Sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, two older brothers. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of laughter in our family. A sign of love was teasing, and so we had a lot of jokes and practical jokes on each other. We had a good time. Mm-hmm. But then after I had the two boys, then Bill was moved to, he went back to get his master's at Auburn, mm-hmm. through the Army. And so I went back to graduate school with the two children. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I got my PhD.
Wow.
Wow. That couldn't have been
microbiology easy. Tales.
Uh-huh.
And then we went to San Francisco for the next assignment, which was a wonderful opportunity. And that's when I started, and it's on my CV, and I can show you that. I worked at UC Berkeley at the high containment lab.
Oh, my.
At the Navy lab. Mm-hmm. And that's when I worked on feline leukemia.
Oh.
And I had 20-something cats. I was the madam of the cat house. Learned about containment facilities because we worked in suits and everything, so I learned a lot during that time. And then I learned through my major professor, actually, about the opportunity at St. Jude's, because Bill was trying to decide whether to continue in the service, because he'd been a pharmacist the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really hard for me, because when they learned that your husband was in service, they didn't view you as a long-term.
Sure.
Yeah.
And he's always been extremely supportive of my career. He said I had a career, not a job, in his view. And so I learned about the job at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital and through my major professor, and so I interviewed for that one, and that was a very peculiar interview, because I assume you're looking for odd things. I was meeting Rob Webster in the airport in Los Angeles, and I was at a meeting in San Diego, so I flew up there, and I'd never met him, so I didn't know what he looked like. So I'm walking, and they won't tell you if somebody's there or not. So I was walking up and down the aisles with my name tag on, trying to find him, and sure enough, he stood up, and that's where we had our interview.
Memphis. Well, you know, we are, of course, I'm sure that people who access these tapes in the future will be interested in odd experiences, but I think people are also interested in, you know, some of the... What might seem more predictable by today's standards, at least, because these are archives that people might access at you know, a long time from now, perhaps. So, go ahead and
I'll be more restrictive then.
Well, no, go ahead and talk about some of the ordinary things too. Who was your major professor?
Dr. Emilio Mora.
Mm-hmm.
Mora.
Okay.
Wonderful man, actually from Mexico, and mm-hmm. he was extremely supportive, I found, of women and minorities, mm-hmm. and I think it came from his experiences.
Mm-hmm. Marina and I were just talking about the fact that it hasn't always been that way.
No. No.
Yeah.
Not a level playing field.
Yeah. Right.
So.
Well, how many, I mean, where's your grad program? Did you have other women? Did he have other women in the lab?
He did. There weren't that many around, clearly, at that time. There weren't many women in science.
That's right.
And I was actually in a poultry science department. I was studying Merrick's disease, viral disease in birds. Mm. And he was just extremely supportive of, and he used to refer to me as his number one, which was always nice.
Mm-hmm.
And he just really... gave opportunities, support, mentoring, was very positive, but I noticed that we had more women and minorities than other labs.
Uh-huh.
I actually think it came from his own background and what he had run into.
Mm-hmm. Because he was from Mexico.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful man.
Yeah. Hmm. That's great.
He was, I had very close contact. He died several years ago, but we had very close contact throughout my career.
Now, in the lead up here to St. Jude's, had you assumed from the beginning that you would be going to college and that you'd be going to graduate school? Was there a big decision there about going on to graduate school? Or
there was no doubt about going to college.
Uh-huh.
Expectation in our family.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. said it was a little unusual that we were married students. But that was never, my parents or his parents never talked about not sending us to college. Mm-hmm. That was just an expectation that everybody would go to college. Mm-hmm. Now, graduate school came up kind of because I wanted to, I specialized in medical laboratory technology and biochemistry. So I initially intended to be a medical technologist. Then I became more intrigued with viruses, and Bill was finishing, a little bit of its circumstances, Bill was finishing up his time, and he was on a different time than I was, so I decided, well, I'll continue my studies during that, and then he left before I finished. So we've had to be flexible about that aspect. We've had periods where one of us has been somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I decided to take advantage of that, and I'd met Dr. Mora, and I thought he would be a wonderful teacher for me. So that's the reason I ended up getting my master's, and I entered it fully intending to go to the PhD. So that was, in my mind, kind of set in my head. And then, but I decided to wait and then pick up again later.
So it sounds as if the experience at St. Jude's was a really important turning point, a really critical part of your development.
Because for several reasons. One, it was a very high-level research activity, which was very good for me. I, in contrast to most people, I never did a postdoc, which you'll know now is very common and everything.
Well,
but then a lot of times we just went to work, which is what I did at UC Berkeley. And so the level of research accomplishment at St. Jude's taught me an enormous amount. The other huge advantage was I ran an international surveillance program in flu. So I traveled around the world. I learned an enormous amount about other countries, other cultures, how to do collaborations at the international global level. That was very pivotal. And then another one was I took a sabbatical at Harvard Med School because I wanted to increase my expertise in immunology. And then when I was there, I had a wonderful mentor there too, Bernie Fields, just a fantastic person, a highly accomplished scientist, wonderful individual. And I really loved being back in the university because I loved the students and all the different things you did. And so when I went back to St. Jude's, that's when I decided to that I wanted to return to university. So I had to pay back my time for the sabbatical, and then after that was when I moved to UW-Madison.
Oh. And how long were you at St. Jude's altogether?
10 years.
Just for the record, what years were those?
Let's see, that was 75 to 85.
Yeah, I think we can probably include a CV with this recording, but I think it's good to have some of the basics on the tape, so... forgive me if I ask some dull questions along with. So really, your decision to come back to a university was partly about the teaching, about the students.
Oh yeah, I've always loved teaching because you get to see the lights go on, and I had some wonderful teachers that were very pivotal in my life. So I've always had great respect for the high value of helping people learn. And I liked all the different activities in the university. And I loved being at St. Jude's. It was a great experience for me and very important in my development. But I missed that aspect of being in a university setting.
Yeah. Why was it UW-Madison? What happened to attract you to UW-Madison?
Well, there were several reasons. First of all, UW-Madison's reputation unto itself. But they started the new veterinary school. And they needed a virologist. And one of the reasons I found out about it, again, was I'd worked collaboratively with Barney Easterday, who was the inaugural dean.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right, and on influenza collaborations over the years, because he was a great collaborator. Madison was a big collaborator in this international program. And so I became aware then of opportunities because they were building that program. And so then when they had... ads for that, I decided to apply.
So were you really in the first cohort of faculty in the new vet school?
I wasn't exactly first, because there were some other folks that had already come in, been on a few years, but not long after that. Mm-hmm. So I think they had been going, well, I moved there in 85.
Uh-huh.
I think they were in the early 80s when they first started. But they were still building the cohort of faculty and staff.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. How many, what, remind me, what department were you in there?
Department of Pathobiological Sciences.
And yeah. And you were probably, what, the fourth or fifth person they hired?
Yeah, they weren't very big. I think it ranged, I think there were at least six or seven when I came.
Uh-huh. Oh, uh-huh. So, okay.
Was it Barney Easterday who actually made you the offer and persuaded you to come, or?
Right, he was pivotal, and then we also we had the veterinary science department. I had colleagues I'd worked with on NDV and some other areas there that I knew, and so and I had a joint appointment, an adjunct appointment in Bed Micro.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Because though, and actually one of the attractiveness of my background was that influenza fits in lots of different areas.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Or mammals and birds.
Uh-huh.
So I had worked in all those different realms with CDC and, you know, all kinds of different groups around the world. Mm-hmm. But it was a way also to maintain a strong influenza program at UW-Madison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was another asset that I brought.
Were there other individuals here who were really influential or that you knew before you came here besides Barney?
I knew Hansen, Bob Hansen, over in Vet Science.
Okay.
I knew, the one in poultry science. I knew several of the ones via poultry science. They had poultry science at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the work on influenza.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I probably knew more of the animal type of virology people at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I knew of Howard Timmon and folks like that, which I got to know really well while I was there. But I was impressed by the virology contingency there, the number of people engaged in virus studies across the campus, and that was a big attraction.
Yeah. Well, what was it like for you and your family moving here to Madison? What were your expectations and experiences in coming here?
Well, we were a little nervous. We'd never, you know, I'd lived in a lot of different places, but I'd never lived in the upper Midwest, and we were a little concerned about the climate.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we decided, well, if we didn't like it, we'd move.
Uh-huh.
But we stayed there actually longer than any place I've lived in my life.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And we were a little apprehensive about that, the lack of diversity in the population there versus the places we had lived.
Uh-huh.
And we had good impressions of the people and everything, but it was... We just knew it would be a different type of environment. And so, but we've always been kind of risk takers, too. So, and again, we moved from my position, and that was an imposition on Bill because he was heading a big, large hospital pharmacy in Memphis. And he interviewed for a job in Madison, but the job was in Atlanta.
Oh.
But for the first year, he commuted back and forth to Atlanta every week.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, just couldn't do that anymore, and we were starting to ignore the fact that he was coming home on weekends, I think. So, you know, because you get used to the rhythm, family life, and he didn't like that, doing that every week.
Yeah.
So he came and started working part-time as a pharmacist in any, you know, different clinics and stuff.
Uh-huh.
In one place, unfortunately, an individual, it's sad, the individual that was heading the pharmacy died, but Bill was the most qualified individual.
Uh-huh.
So that's how he ended up getting his job there.
Oh, my. So he had to take a sort of a step back in his career at first in order to make this work.
He's moved multiple times from my position.
Yeah.
Pharmacists are more flexible in that regard, but it's still the same problem as you become more senior.
Yeah.
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 It's a give and take, and I'm a little bit more restrictive because of the virology and then administration. So he has moved for, let's see, at least 4 or 5 times from my position.
What was your department like in the beginning? It was obviously small. Did it seem like a good fit?
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, it was developing, and there's a lot of excitement about the potential of the vet school. And one of the things that I was expected to do early on was to connect with the rest of the community, the campus community.
Uh-huh. Oh.
Because they saw that as a strength because of my discipline, but also somewhat my personality. To be sure, you know, if you're a small school in a large university, you need to establish strong connections and partnerships across the campus.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, that was a sign of things to come.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. And so there's a lot of freedom to do that because, you know, my job was not to turn veterinary students into virologists.
Mm-hmm.
No.
It was to teach them virology and be useful to them. So I spent a lot of time in the clinics picking up, because I'm not a veterinarian. Picking up cases and working with the veterinarians to figure out what the students needed to know.
Mm-hmm. So you were your teaching was mainly with DVMs to become. I mean, students who were becoming vets.
That was my primary responsibility, but I also taught in undergraduate and graduate courses as well.
Oh. Uh-huh. Did you come as an assistant professor?
No, I came as an associate professor.
Associate professor. I see. Okay. So you never really had to worry about tenure and so on. That was a given from the start.
I came up in an untenured system, though. St. Jude's didn't do that.
Yeah, uh-huh, right.
I was on soft money, had to generate my own.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
Uh-huh. What were your impressions of the university as a whole, then, when you got here?
I thought it was exciting, and I was enjoying getting to learn. I love to learn, and that's, my husband tells me that every time I get comfortable in my knowledge, I start looking to do something because I like to learn. And so there was a lot to learn, a lot to learn about how to get things done, the people you needed, setting up a new lab, getting started, seeing where your contacts were going to be. So it was very busy, very exciting, teaching a course that I had not taught before. And so there was a lot of activity. It was extremely busy.
Mm-hmm. So really, when you came here, it was clear from the outset that that the expectations were teaching, the campus network building, the research, of course. Those were the three big expectations when you came.
Particularly the research arena, because that's one I brought in.
Well, you always got good grades with your students too.
Right.
And high marks. I'm curious, where'd Tina Turner come from?
That's an interesting story, but I am a huge Tina Turner fan, as you know.
Yes.
But I saw the film Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, where, you know, the pigs produce the methane to run the electricity in this city from their feces.
Mm-hmm.
And because they had a nuclear holocaust, and this city has, you know, everything's radioactive, and so they have to generate all their electricity, and the pigs are critical in that. Mm-hmm. So I saw this movie, but meanwhile, for some reason, I had bought this Tina Turner wig in England, and I didn't know what I was going to do with it at that time, but it seemed kind of interesting. So I got this idea about when the veterinary students came in, I would give them a job at the first class. And what I did is I put the video of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome with the pigs making methane, and Tina Turner is the boss. And meanwhile, I'd already done my normal syllabus and everything.
Okay.
But then I would go out and change into a Tina Turner attire. So the wig and the miniskirt and the leather jacket and the boots, and I'd come back in and tell them that I had a job. They were the attending veterinarian for Bartertown, this town in the movie, and my pigs were sick. Next class, they had to tell me what they knew about it and what they were going to do about it. And of course, meanwhile, the kids are staring, you know, kind of shocked. But and she never physically came back, but she asked questions throughout the semester.
Oh, she did.
The reason I did it is because I had noticed this was, I think, after my first year of teaching, that, you know, a lot of the students weren't as actively engaged in the class. And I always used group learning experiences during classes. I had little groups within the courses. Mm-hmm. And I made them do group presentations. Mm-hmm. Everybody had to present during the semester. And I found them not being as creative and as liberated as I thought they should be. So I figured if I would take a risk like this, mm-hmm. that would say to them, you can take a risk in what you present during your class presentation. And it just totally upgraded the presentations. They were much more creative, very humorous in many cases, of course, but they really got into it a lot more. So to me, it was a pedagogical issue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I could set a tone in the classroom that we were going to be an active, participatory class. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that you could take risk. There weren't bad questions. The only bad one was one that wasn't asked. Mm-hmm. And so it changed the environment in the classroom. And we brought in Mary Rouse, dressed as a mouse, the dean of students. And unfortunately, we had to euthanize her.
You did.
Everybody got into it. Got some visibility because it was certainly kind of unusual, but... I still use the wig and everything. I use the wig to illustrate how influenza viruses change. Uh-huh. Undergo change all the time because I have an antibody that fits on my head.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I still use that because it's been a very effective tool in teaching people about flu. Uh-huh. And it's unusual for people to do things where they'd say, oh, that looks funny. Uh-huh. But it's a very effective teaching mechanism because it sticks.
For the benefit of any of a researcher or journalist who might be listening to this tape at some unknown time in the future, maybe you could say a little bit about all the ways in the outside the classroom in which you've used your Tina Turner impression.
Oh, I think it's been very helpful. I haven't dressed as Tina too many times. I actually did it recently here.
You did
in Hawaii.
It was actually for an engineering centennial celebration, and we had Tina and the Teenettes, and I had the coach and the foundation vice president and the president of the system, and they were the Teenettes, and I was Tina, and we were lip-syncing to Proud Mary. It was just for good. In that case, it was just for good fun and to know that, you know, we're people. Mm-hmm. We can enjoy and have fun and do something that's rather unusual and just be normal. Uh-huh. Of course, that might not be considered normal by me.
What was the reaction?
The illustration with the wig frequently, because to many groups, from grade school kids up to retirement homes, lots of different public groups, rotaries, all kinds of civic groups, because it's a way to communicate a complex issue in a visual kind of lasting example of how flu works and why it's a continual problem.
Yeah. Was there any reaction from your colleagues when you started teaching in a somewhat unconventional way?
Well, they thought it was unusual, clearly. I also was Cruella DeVille 1 year, with the warts on the dogs.
Yep. Yeah. This is a reference for the benefit of a future listener. This is a reference to 101 Dalmatians.
Right, and the dogs had warts, so they had to solve that problem.
Well, Barney Easterday has a good sense of humor, so I assume that he thought this was just fine.
Oh, yeah, Donna Shalala loved it. It was really interesting. We did have, I think there was one individual, a supporter of the school, who called up and wanted to know if this person actually worked there. But it did show up in the newspaper and things like that. But actually, it was very positive, and most students have always remembered it when I'd see them years later.
Oh, I'm sure they did, yeah.
They never quite forgot that, and they, I think, you know, my goal with them, particularly when they weren't going to be virologists, they were going to be veterinarians, mm-hmm. is I said, my success will be if in 5 years you see an article about virology, you pick it up and read it, understand it, you know, appreciate the impact of it.
Yeah, right, good. You know, Ginger, at times we'll ask you for your candid evaluation of people, and I probably should say right now that in case we haven't already told you this, that you'll be getting a form from the Oral History Archives Project, which you can put any conditions that you want on the release of the tape. In other words, if you want to say the tape should be withheld, except with your explicit permission, the tape should be withheld until, you know, 2035 or whatever, or that'll be entirely up to you. For example, when I did my interview, I put a constraint on the tape until after I die or I forget some date, whichever came first.
When you're going to?
So I just wanted to let you know that if there's some candid evaluation that you want to say at any point, you know, that you'll have a chance to put limits on just when that could be released to somebody listening to it.
Okay.
Which leads us to a question that's on the outline here at this point. It says, please comment frankly on colleagues, particularly those who mentored you or factions or important support staff or your relationship with the dean or whatever. So far it sounds as if your introduction to Madison was really positive and supportive, but if there's something less than that, and you want to talk about it, please do.
Okay.
So you've arrived at, it's the mid-80s, you've arrived at Madison, you've taken up these new duties, your husband is...
finally back in Madison?
Yeah, right. Tell us a little bit about how your department evolved then after the after this beginning.
Well, we grew in numbers somewhat, but we weren't a large, a really large department. Mm-hmm. There were a number of folks within it, virologists and pathologists that I worked with a lot. But you know, biological sciences covers a kind of a wide range. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was an unusual name. It's kind of like the living dead. I also became very engaged with the virology community, mm-hmm. as a whole, you know, from the different groups, Roland Rickert, Howard Timmon, the McArdle group, the virology group across the campus. So they became a lot of my colleagues. Mm-hmm. Kevin Schultz was in the department, and he and I worked jointly. He was a virologist, too, and you know, setting up ways to share equipment, that was a big issue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because we were all trying to generate as much as we could, and we did a lot more of sharing in the new way we were setting up at the school.
Yeah. And later in your administrative career, you found that sharing equipment was a hot issue everywhere on campus forever.
One of the things I think I learned early on was the partnering. Mm-hmm. I call it passing sandbox 101.
And there were some who didn't
sandbox,
pass?
Sandbox, work together, share, and get a better outcome. And yeah. I think that's pivotal. And to me, that has been kind of a mantra, mm-hmm. is how can you partner effectively? And, you know, even when we'd have junior faculty come in, and one of the things I did a lot of times, let them get started in the lab I had so that they wouldn't spend forever setting up their own lab. They needed to get started faster, and there are a lot of delays getting up incubators or things like that. So, you know, that's a good outcome because the junior people are your future.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's terrific, and not everybody does it, for sure. Were you the only woman in your department at first?
I think there was one other one at that time, Karen Young. They'd already come, mm-hmm. so there was one other one.
So that that aspect of diversity, at least, wasn't maybe quite such a big issue as it was in some other parts of campus at the time?
No, there weren't many women in the school.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There were increasing women in the clinical area, but there were very few tenure track, and there, you know, clearly the predominance in virology were, they were male. Mm-hmm.
Who was the chair of the department at the beginning?
Ron Schultz.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And who was the associate dean for research? It was Barney Easterday, but who was it with him?
I'm trying to remember. I must have worked with him a lot.
I can't remember either.
Mm-hmm. Remember. The, I don't remember. I should, but I don't.
Did you get brought into some of the women's issues? I know Robin, you and Robin Dowitt became good friends, and in the early 90s, she was very active trying to make some things happen. Were you in that group?
Yeah. The yes, indeed. And actually, you know, one of my greatest mentors and certainly impacted on my life in a lot of ways is Donna Shalala. And the reason I hooked up with Robin was because a number of us were appointed to the athletic board.
Oh, yeah.
And that was when Donna did that, and that's how I met a lot of the women across, you know, because she appointed a number of women. Robin was certainly one of my major mm-hmm. colleagues, and that's when we were working on the mentoring program for women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that was about, we're talking about maybe 1990 by now, or 1991, somewhere in there?
And that was, no, it's earlier than that.
Oh.
No, it was earlier than that when I have to look back on my own CV. Because, let's see, 85 and 95. No, that's probably right. That's probably right. You're probably right, Chuck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you become chair of the department at some point? I've forgotten, Ginger.
I've never been a chair.
Oh, really?
You'll find that's not uncommon for senior women in my age group because I don't think that would have really been possible in a lot of the situations for us at that time, mm-hmm. particularly mm-hmm. in the sciences. Mm-hmm. So if you saw women moving into administration, a lot of times they did it centrally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There were more opportunities there than actually in the chair's positions.
Uh-huh. After a while, anyway, there were. Yeah.
I think if you look at the data at UW-Madison, you will see that this definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing Marina and I have been doing together the last couple of years is running the Kaufman Seminar, which is introduction to the culture and history of the university, what makes Wisconsin different, what's special about this place for up-and-coming administrators. What was your impression of the culture of this university? You'd been at Berkeley, among other places. Did you have a feeling that the culture of this place was different in any way?
I thought it was different in the fact that I don't think they were accustomed to dealing with diversity. It's a very Wisconsin's a more homogeneous state. And that was notable to me. Mm-hmm. I think they just hadn't had a lot of experience in dealing with diversity, whether it be gender or race or sexual orientation or what. They didn't seem very experienced in that regard.
So in a way, Wisconsin came across as a little bit naive.
Yeah, and a little bit... well, I'll give you an example. A little sanctimonious in that they, we would hear comments about, well, you're from the South, and because we'd moved from Memphis, and so therefore we must be bigots. Therefore, our children would have to repeat grades. Things of that nature. They were a little arrogant about the perceptions they had as being reality, which they weren't.
People actually suggested that you might be bigots and your kids might be stupid because you were from the South?
And that the schools there couldn't possibly be as good. Uh-huh. And there certainly are schools that aren't, but ours were well prepared. Yeah. We didn't have a problem. Uh-huh. And we actually moved one son there as a senior. Because we were going to stay another year, and we decided being lame duck was just not a good thing. I don't believe in staying lame duck. I move quickly when I move. Mm-hmm. And so we decided, well, maybe he'd view Madison as home if we moved him. And so that was a little traumatic, but actually worked out quite well. And they enjoyed the fact, what they enjoyed about Madison, too, is people didn't have too many preconceived notions when you move into a new place, except they noticed that because they were from the South and they had a Southern accent at that point, people had stereotypes in their heads. And also they thought that, and Wisconsin thought they had the ideal, but they had very little knowledge about how to deal with diversity because they'd never done. And that's what I saw in the students that came in from the state, is that they weren't biased. They just didn't know how to react because the people weren't just like them.
So you're teaching vet students from, particularly from all over Wisconsin, including, of course, rural areas, and you're seeing some students who are pretty naive about the rest of the world.
Yeah, yeah, I think they had grown up in a different, and I did take, I love the Kaufman program. I also did the CIC program.
Oh, yeah, and they often go together.
I also did the Wisconsin Ideas Seminar, which I thought was pivotal.
Ah.
I would like to give credit to that because for two reasons. I met a great colleague, Linda Weimer, on that one. But also it helped you learn about the state and from whence your students come.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I thought that helped me a lot in knowing how to reach the students.
Yeah. It helped you understand these students who otherwise might have seemed rather ignorant about the rest of the world, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and also that Madison was not Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people come into Madison and they think, well, the rest of the state's this way. It's not. And so we went through everything from, you know, small dairy farms to big businesses to alumni groups to boat building places to the reservations. I thought that was an invaluable program, and I'm actually trying to do that here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great idea. Wow.
Honolulu is not Hawaii.
Yeah.
No, you're right. It is not.
Again, maybe for the benefit of somebody who might be listening to this in the future, I should probably say that the Wisconsin Idea Seminar is a week-long bus trip around the state, going to the places that Chancellor Hinshaw has just mentioned, with a guide, it's meant to be it's meant to be just exactly what it was for her, an introduction to the rest of the state, and also an opportunity for people around the state to get to know the university folks.
And then you feel bonded early on. I think it was key. I thought those leadership opportunities, the the Wisconsin Ideas Seminar helped prepare me. In fact, we ended up with a Wisconsin Ideas Seminar in the graduate school, which was an unusual place for it. But I felt it was just so important to help people become great local citizens as well as great professional faculty members, staff members.
Did you have graduate students, forgive my ignorance, did you have graduate students at the same time as the professional students?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Are there any of them that you particularly want to mention, anything about the experience of teaching these graduate students that you think should be recorded?
Well, I think everybody engaged in the university should teach. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that way, that it made me better at my science, in my science understanding, and having to teach in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
Because they come up with questions that you haven't thought about, and that's really good for you as a professional. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly I needed other groups to help me with regard to virology learning. But I really enjoyed teaching the different groups, and I also taught in undergraduates, mm-hmm. particularly freshman courses, because I thought that was a good experience, and also they needed to see professional women as faculty. You know, this could be your future.
And these undergraduates
from schools while I was there, because that's kind of the turnoff point for young girls with regard to science and minorities. So I really felt, and my first own personal graduate student was Hannah Van Kampen, who I just saw 2 weeks ago. I keep close touch with my graduate students. And she was actually from Hawaii.
Oh.
She was a returning student. She was a veterinarian. She'd been out working. So she was my first graduate student at UW-Madison.
Oh, my gosh. And your undergraduates now, they were enrolled in what in what program?
Usually in letters and science type programs. Uh-huh. They had, you know, Phil started that program, Ways of Knowing, which I dearly loved, where they'd have people come in and talk to the undergraduates. So I would do seminar spots in those different programs. The courses I taught were usually at the graduate or the professional level.
The for listeners, the reference to Phil is to Phil Certain, former Dean of Letters and Science. Tell us a little bit more about your research program. Now, let's see, we got to keep an eye on the time here because we know you have a limited amount of time right now. But perhaps this is a good time to say a little bit more about your research career. What kind of, where you got funding support? Did WARF play a role in that? And what about federal agencies and other and sources of private support? What where was the support for your research program?
Yeah, when I was at St. Jude's, we had an NIH program, just a surveillance. But we had other, because we had to generate our own support, too. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to UW-Madison, I was kind of starting from scratch to a certain extent because I didn't transfer with me. So I generated support via NIH. But I also worked a lot with different pork producers, the poultry people, generating, trying to pick up funding there. Got funding from the grad school, from land grant support we had for the institution. So at the beginning, I was, you know, having to generate a lot to get started.
Kind of from scratch. Wow, that's not easy to do.
No, it wasn't, and so it was a big decision in that regard because St. Jude's had strong funding sources. But I really, as I said, my driver was being back in an institution, and I also wanted to have my own program.
You want to say a little bit about some of your publications? I know that the titles and so on will be on your CV, but which, by the way, we don't have in front of us today, but do you want to say anything about lines of publication that you feel were particularly significant in their impact or significant for you as a scholar?
Well, the I think the definition of the enormous size of influenza viruses in different populations, particularly migratory ducks, I had a number of publications along those lines because we are identifying natural reservoirs of influenza viruses. So I think those were pivotal. I think the issues related to swine influenza and the prevalence of that in the pig populations and the relationship with people. Some of the more unusual was usual type of endeavor was when we were looking at seals and the discovery that seals, marine mammals, have influenza being transmitted from birds.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and so that was a very unusual one and a fascinating one, actually.
Yeah.
I got in more later on into cell biology and apoptosis and how flu viruses could induce apoptosis as a mechanism of pathogenesis. To me, that was quite fascinating. But a lot of my work dealt with the interspecies transmission and looking for instances where that would happen and what would lend itself to that and what was the origin. So it moved from the animal to the genetics. We used to spend many, many, many hours sequencing virus genomes, which now you hand somebody else to do. But that was the beginning of some of that technology and also the computer developments during that time to store data and analyze data. That was a very exciting time in that regard. And also, when I went to UW-Madison, one thing I really benefited from was being able to visualize viral proteins three-dimensionally.
Ah, yeah.
And identifying changes. There was one change in the hemagglutinin, the viral attachment protein, that was particularly pivotal on host range and tissue tropism. Mm-hmm. I found that quite exciting. Mm-hmm. So it focused on it, but it was ecology, because you had to understand the ecology of flu. Mm-hmm. And I used to make all my students go out and take samples and learn where the viruses came from. But so they'd be out sampling different populations, picking up bird droppings and all kinds of things, sampling pigs, because I wanted them to appreciate that you had to understand the ecological setting for the virus, as well as being able then to take it to the lab and, you know, define the genetic changes in the host range and the virulence. I spent a good bit of time on working with highly virulent influenza viruses, determine why they caused as much cell death as they did.
Hmm. Maybe for the benefit, again, for somebody listening at some time in the future, we should say that we're having this conversation at a time when the threat of an influenza pandemic is considered very real, and when avian flu in particular is a mm-hmm. is a pretty hot topic. Your research was well ahead of the time when people recognized those threats, it seems.
Yeah, in fact, we had one proposal where we were trying to stockpile some of the H5 and H7s to use in case of the event of a pandemic involving those particular ones, because they were particularly hot. I think that I also worked on new approaches to vaccines, like DNA vaccines and things of that nature, because you could see then, as an influenza person, the vaccine production was not really ideal, because one of the things, if you have a hot strain that kills chickens, first of all, you don't have the eggs to grow the virus for a vaccine, because it's still grown in embryonated chicken eggs, and because it kills the eggs. And so, you know, trying to come up with new strategies for vaccines was critically important. And I think actually this current problem with H5N1, the outcome of that will be better vaccine approaches, because now they're being forced to look at different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the hot topics today is the possibility of developing vaccines from that don't take so long to develop. developing vaccines much faster in response to emerging viruses.
That'll be an outcome. I give a lot of talks on flu still. Mm-hmm. I'm intellectually engaged now. I had to make the decision when I went into administration full-time as to whether to continue my lab, and I made the decision not to, because I felt I needed to be focusing on other people's programs, not my own. Mm. So that it took me 2 years to, that's when I became Dean of Graduate School and Vice Chancellor for Research. Mm-hmm. And so then I did close down my lab, so I've not run a lab since then. Mm-hmm. But I still intellectually stay engaged, and I serve on some boards that deal with flu.
Must be hard to do that as a chancellor. I guess we're running a little ahead of our topics here, but that's a hard thing to do.
Hard thing.
We're just about at the end of the hour here, Ginger, and let's talk a little bit about what you'd like to do next. We haven't even gotten to your administrative service, even that which preceded being Dean of the Graduate School and Vice Chancellor for Research. Shall we schedule another time?
That'd be good. That's okay. I like hearing
from
y'all.
Okay. How about if, by the way, please say thank you to Karen Ikoma. We do thank her for her patience. I know it isn't easy to set all these things up, and our schedules have changed and so on. Tell her we really appreciate her patience. How about if you let her know what you'd like to do, and she has our
emails.
Both of our email addresses, and she can just email us, and we can maybe she could send us a couple of times that might be available, and we'll let her know if we can do it. How would that be?
If there are any questions you want me to know ahead of time, that's fine too.
Oh, that's a good idea. Do you have time for that right now?
Yeah, that'd be good. Oh,
well,
you can email either one.
Yeah. Why don't we email some
the outline?
There's an outline here. We're coming to the last page of the outline, but it's about your university service. About your in your case, it would be your administrative service. particularly, and that's obviously important. So I think we need at least another hour, I would think, to do justice to that that story. So
he was one of my big mentors in that arena.
So we'll send you the whole outline by email, and you can see what we might have missed, and particularly you want to look at the questions that are on the last page in preparation for our next conversation.
Although even those, they don't really go into major administrative posts.
Yeah, it's a generic outline, and it doesn't really ask specific questions that would be appropriate to somebody at your level. So but you can see what sorts of things are covered, and that'll give you an idea what you want to talk about. I mean, it's really all about what you want to talk about. The outline is not a controlling document of any kind. It's really about your story.
Well, there is one thing I remembered from when I first got to UW-Madison.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was very interesting, actually, because I was very excited and everything. And the chancellor had a welcome tea or something that I went to. And there was one fellow there who came up to me and made a snide remark about, "I understand that you knew the dean of the veterinary school, and that's why you're here."
Oh.
Well, first of all, I was one of the few women at this event, because there weren't that many women faculty, actually. And I was, first of all, and this fellow was not on the committee that reviewed my information for application, because what he's inferring is I didn't earn my keep.
Right.
And so I went to the officials and complained. I said, first of all, that was inappropriate.
Yes.
And I said, that's my welcome to UW-Madison. So they actually addressed it because there had been somebody on the committee that had made a comment, well, she knows the dean, which I did. There was no doubt. I never hid that.
Sure.
But that didn't. That I earned the appointment and the tenure based on my own productivity and background. But that was an upsetting moment when I had first entered, and I said, "Well, that's not a very nice welcome."
I should say not. Mm-hmm. And anybody who knew Barney yesterday and knew about his integrity and knew how much he cared about getting the vet school off to the right kind of start would know that he would never have made an appointment on the basis of friendship.
No, and as I said, you know, actually Barney and I were more just, we were professional colleagues. We had been for a good while at that point, because flu wasn't a huge area at that point. But it wasn't, you know, it was just solely that they needed a virologist.
Yeah.
And flu fit well there, and so I did all the interviews and all the stuff that everybody else did, and they were supportive. But I think this was just, it also made me, what it raised in my mind, too, was always the concern, well, I'm a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that comes up, and so you're sensitive to that because of it coming up during your career, and it certainly has during mine.
Do you mind saying whom you took this complaint to? How did you pursue this?
To Barney.
Uh-huh.
But then I also went to somebody in Central, and I can't remember who it was at the time, mm-hmm. to talk about the fact that this wasn't. I think it ended up being all the way through the thing that this was totally inappropriate, mm-hmm. and if somebody was talking about something out of school that was inappropriate, it was inappropriate comment anyhow.
Sure.
But this person wouldn't have had access to some of the information he was transmitting to me because he wasn't on the committee.
No. Right.
Somebody on the committee had been, so it went back to the group that had been making the decision.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, you know, if you think of other stories like that, other things that you think are important for portraying the times and your story particularly, please do feel free to tell them at any point in the interview. And in fact, what'll happen, Ginger, I should probably mention this, is that there's a staff member here at the Oral History Project who listens to these and just makes an outline of topics. They don't put they don't transcribe the interview, and they don't put, you know, things that might be considered confidential for now into an outline, but just an outline of topics, so that in the future, when a researcher or a journalist is trying to study this, they'll know roughly where on the tape to look for things that are of interest to their topic.
I think the one of the things is that you'll probably learn from talking with any senior women, but particularly in science, that there were multiple challenges along the way. And since I was brought up not to think there were any blocks, mm-hmm. I had to learn that to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But also I learned to speak up and, you know, address it.
Yeah.
And some of those experiences helped me do that. It also made me sensitive to the fact that if I faced it, others did as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's for sure.
As you become more senior, as you know, that fear becomes lessened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of times we're having to speak up for the young people because we can take more risk.
Yeah.
I remember once I got one really great, I was going to an international virology meeting, but I looked at the program and there were no women speaking. And so I thought that was incorrect. So I wrote the person that was organizing and said, you know, this really isn't appropriate. There are women in virology that could certainly fit in this role, and it sends a bad message and other things. Mm-hmm. And I had support from my male virologists, including Howard Timmon and Kevin Schultz. They were all supporting this issue as well. Mm-hmm. It didn't go over real well with the person I wrote to. Uh-huh. And so what I ended up doing is I boycotted. Because I said, if I'm going to invest the resources I have in attending a meeting, I want to attend those in which I'm a full participant.
Right.
My colleagues are, both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to an immunology meeting instead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Things like that. But I also had the one thing at UW-Madison during some of those times to make statements is I had good support from a number of my male colleagues.
Including Barney, I'm sure, and were there others in particular that you should be mentioned? Howard?
I think Howard Timmon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very liberating. One of the things I always looked for when I was trying to work on women's issues, I looked for fathers with daughters.
Yeah, that's right.
They certainly wanted their daughters to have ample opportunity to succeed, and so they understood just innately. And Howard was great. Kevin Schultz was great. Because there were a lot more men in the community, you had to appeal to that community.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supportive. But you had to look for those opportunities and do it in a, you know, an upfront, civil manner, but make statements.
Mm-hmm.
And as you became more senior, you could make more of those statements. And sometimes had a little oomph behind them, too.
I'm sure one thing that people will be interested in at some point, you can address it now or later if you wish. What was it like to work with Howard Timmon?
I had the utmost respect for Howard. He was a very unique individual, extremely, extremely bright, needless to say. He used to scare us to death because he would look like he wasn't paying attention during the seminar, and then he would ask the most pivotal question in the room.
Mm-hmm.
He was tough, but he was fair, and I thought he was a very socially conscious individual.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him stand up for people with HIV, very respectful manner. He was always saying, this is a virus, this is what we're dealing with, it doesn't, you know, because a lot of people when it first started were very anti the populations that were particularly suffering from it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a hallmark of principle in my view.
Mm-hmm.
And as he became ill later on, he and I became quite close. I spoke at his memorial at UW-Madison. I just had enormous respect for him both personally and professionally.
And obviously that was widely shared.
And he was a mentor when I was thinking about going into administration. I talked to Howard about it.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, he said, well, of course, that'd be the last thing he'd want to do. He said, yeah. But he thought that I had the skill sets and they needed strong science leaders, mm-hmm. and people that understood the value of research mm-hmm. in institutions. And so he was supportive of that from my viewpoint. And so I had a lot of discussions with him about it before I decided to do it.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Who else was influential in that decision?
Well, I did something where I worked half-time in administration before I decided to go into it full-time.
Right. Was that the appointment you had? I can't remember if it was full-time or part-time. The appointment you had in which the assignment was basically to straighten out the biological sciences, organize the biological sciences?
Yeah, that was my half-time.
That was
it. And I actually kind of worked into administration, and I found that I knew that I, when I was on a committee, I found that I liked to chair it, not to dominate it, but rather to guide it and make sure it got something done.
Yeah.
Because I'm a time recovery nut. I like for people's time to be value added, mm-hmm. including my own. And so that was why I liked to chair them, because you could set up the agenda and get things done. And I also liked the committees with the authority and responsibility to do things.
Which committees were particularly important to you as you thought about taking more leadership responsibilities?
Well, this is going to sound unusual, but being on the athletic board was pivotal for two reasons. One, you were making decisions, and they were important. I was on academic and personnel. Mm-hmm. And then also, you were exposed to a much broader audience associated with the community, with the mm-hmm. campus. You learned to interact with lots of different folks in that position. Mm-hmm. The other one, the Biological Sciences Tenure Committee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I chaired that one. I served on it, and I chaired it. Those were two that I thought were fairly pivotal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lately around here, we've had some well-publicized accusations that the decisions of the athletic board are not actually taken seriously, that the faculty members in particular are not truly respected or consulted. That was not your experience, I'm inferring.
No, I think maybe it was because the group that was put on there all at one time, came in there. I was unusual because here I am, I'm a scientist, but I was a parent of athletes. Mm-hmm. And so I came in with a different perspective, but we came in with a strong group. Mm-hmm. Susan Lubar was the community alum mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And certainly Robin and Linda. Mm-hmm. We had several that came in on at one time, and we took it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And they were listening to us, particularly with regard to academics and personnel,
mm-hmm.
Because we were not quiet souls.
No. And you were appointed by Donna, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. I had to come off when I went into administration full time.
Yeah. Okay. I'm happy to keep going. I don't know if Mari is too. How about you, Ginger? I know you've got a busy day ahead of you.
About 5 more minutes and I have to go to a meeting.
5 minutes. All right. Okay. Well, so we're at this juncture now where you're taking on a rather hefty, supposedly half-time administrative assignment. You still got your lab. You're still teaching. Tell us a little bit more about that. This is a pretty important decision point for you.
Right. It was interesting because I found that I was intrigued by facilitating progress and making opportunities for others, and that's what kind of intrigued me with going into administration. But I wanted to try it, and so I went into that one. And it was wonderful because there was no assignment, basically. It's just to fix the biological sciences, which was not terribly specific.
who appointed you to that position and when? I think we should get that on the tape.
But that was David Ward was the chancellor at that time. John Wiley was the provost.
Right.
So I worked in John's office.
Yeah.
And
so this was about 1994.
I think so.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I have to check my CV myself.
Yeah.
93, 94.
And so I did that for a year and a half, actually.
Mm-hmm.
and that's about right timing, 93 to 94. Mm-hmm. And it was, so it was kind of wide open. So I looked, I studied, I listened, I heard what people thought were big issues, and one was certainly a biology undergraduate major. And like many institutions, we developed a lot of different specialties after World War II, when people, you know, there are a lot of people coming in, a lot of research dollars. And so things kind of got sparsed out into smaller and smaller units. Mm-hmm. And that made it hard for people that wanted to have core programs. So I decided that was one that we should address, mm-hmm. is a biology undergraduate major that was a little more cohesive, mm-hmm. for students. There were some programs in the biological sciences research and other areas that I worked on too, but that was one that certainly occupied a good bit of time.
And that same fragmentation had affected biology PhD programs to the point that some of them were extremely small. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe a little provincial. Was that the case? And you were asked to kind of address that too, right?
And that actually proved to be very helpful for my, you know, next position, because you could see that fragmentation. And in graduate education, there were big changes going on there. Students were looking for critical mass. Mm-hmm. Breadth, choice. They weren't looking to, you know, hone in on one thing really quickly in a lot of cases. And so trying to get more of a group approach to some of these areas. And there was another benefit. It brought the faculty together. Mm-hmm. That was actually one of the bigger impacts, was bringing faculty members together to see where they could, over, you know, cooperate, collaborate. And that was a big value that came out of those exercises, I think. Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit more about the exercises themselves? I mean, you started out by listening, trying to understand what people's definition of the problem, definitions of the problem, problems were, and then what?
Well, then we developed scenarios, and we used, actually, I worked with Ann Palmerberg a bit on one of these, a fellow biologist. We had a tree where you'd come in and take certain number of core courses, and then you'd be branching out until finally you might have gotten to a leaf. It was to show where you needed to have certain core courses, and then as people wanted to, as they got, you know, they progressed in their studies, they might want to go off onto a branch, but then how you could make that more cohesive and smoother, and then also the expectations off of those branches. Mm-hmm. And so we actually used that tree a good bit in trying to symbolize, if you were a student coming in, what would you need, how would you need to progress through this system and end up where you wanted to be?
Mm-hmm. So
a lot of discussions and programs around those different trees and how far out you should go. Mm-hmm. And I think that impacted on, you know, the smaller units and everybody thinking about, well, how close to the branch do I want to be?
Did you have problems with people who, I mean, essentially there were some people you were saying, well, this course or this program is really part of the trunk of the tree, it's really part of the core, and this program is really much more specialized, you're really one of the smaller branches. Was there disagreement about that?
Oh, yes. A good bit, actually.
It's kind of a dumb question, right? Yeah.
But, you know, everybody thinks that they're the core course. And so that's natural human nature. But being in an outer course myself, virology was not, you know, a core course for most people. Mm-hmm. So being out there on one of the limbs was probably helpful from my perspective, because I knew I wasn't to begin with. Mm-hmm. But where could our courses add value? Mm-hmm. You know, we were out on one of the branches, so that was okay. But there was much disagreement and also some contentiousness about who would be the core courses and where they would be taught and mm-hmm. what school and college and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So after all this, I mean, it sounds like a lot of listening, a lot of negotiation, a lot of debate about what the core should look like and how students should progress toward more specialized knowledge. At the end of all this, what did you have? What was the product?
It kept on going. We had a certain stage when I switched to the other position, but eventually they had a biology degree, undergraduate major. And so I think that did help in lots of different ways, looking at courses, saying which ones really need to be taught now. You know, you can't just teach your specialty course. I think it had a lot of impact on that aspect, and you'd have to look now and see if it's still paying off for folks.
Well, it's, as I understand it, and you know this is not my field, but as I understand it, this has continued to develop over the years, and there is more consensus these days, I think, about what a biology major should look like, and a lot clearer communication with students. I think we've moved in that direction. We've continued to move in that direction, I think.
And they should evolve. I think people, when you look back at and think about things that have been successful, if they become integrated and continue to evolve and get better, that's success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about on the PhD side? There were, at one time, there were, what, 80-some different PhDs in biology. How did you attack that problem, and how far did it, were you able to get with it?
I think we made a lot of progress on that, and it's going to sound like an onion. And we attacked it a little bit by through program review, because you had to review all these programs, and when you have multitudinous ones, that's a lot of faculty and staff time. And so we reviewed this. We had a great graduate executive council, and I thought they did a great job. We worked very carefully with them about, you know, where the impact. You know, we had data for them. Marita's really clear. And this was already done, the profiles, so you could follow what your progress was, how many students you had, how long it took them, what kind of support they had. Jane Fox was wonderful in that regard. And so we could evaluate based on data and also look at whether they could be stronger if they were within another program. And I give you one example. We used to make people give reviews. When I first joined, I thought the program review was dreadful. It really didn't amount to much, and we gave the same attention to those that were doing spectacularly well as those that needed help. And so we boiled it down. You had three overheads after we made sure everybody knew how to use overheads. Three overheads you could do the good points, the need improvement points, and then recommendations. And we took it very seriously. And, for example, one that came through that I remember vividly was pharmacy. They had six different programs, and very few in each one. It took a, Marita probably remembers this one too.
Very few students.
A lot of people time and energy, and they weren't really stellar, but together, so we ended up merging them. And so that together they developed a critical mass and became stronger and had better numbers, and they excelled. So those were some of the changes that I thought were particularly beneficial, and that was kind of the strategy we used. It was moving towards excellence. It was not you're a bad program or whatever, but what will make you more excellent. We also made groups recruit together. We supported them if they would recruit together. And that was another place where we found it was very beneficial to get the faculty together from different groups, but also the students, but clearly the faculty. Those are some of the strategies is set up ways where they can get together and realize the value that the others could add to them and the critical mass of intellect. And the students like that. They liked seeing this wonderful collection of opportunities and intellect from which they could learn.
Great. Well, I think we probably trespassed on your 5 minutes pretty severely here, and we better let you get to your next meeting.
Take care.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ginger. We really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to talk to you and to hear about this story. And with Karen's help,
we're a lot in Hawaii.
Pardon?
We do what's called talk story.
Yeah, that's right. So with Karen's help, we'll set up another appointment at some time that's convenient for you, and we'll pick up the story from here. Okay.
Sounds great. Y'all take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye.